John Ottman has been the editor and composer for director Bryan Singer since their first short together, 1988's Lion's Den, and they continue to work on such hits as The Usual Suspects, the X-Men movies, Superman Returns, and Valkyrie. When Singer was fired off of the Freddie Mercury biopic Bohemian Rhapsody, it was Ottman, together with producers Graham King and Dennis O'Sullivan, who got this musical epic up on the screen. Ottman explains how he did it on today's Crew Call.
The first question I have is, coming aboard the movie, what did Queen mean to you growing up? Did you see them in concert? And just basically the inspirations for this. I have to think that you saw a lot of concert,
concert films. No, I'm a geek that watched Star Trek growing up and knew nothing about Queen until I saw Flash Gordon. I admit it. But you know, it's very much like when I saw Star Trek, the motion picture, and discovered Jerry Goldsmith. And then I was a crazy Jerry Goldsmith nut. He was a film composer, by the way.
Right.
For people who don't know what he's. And then I became such a fanatic, I went back to the 60s and started collecting all of his film scores. So it was the same thing with Queen. Once they did that score, I was like, oh, this is cool. So then I started listening to all their stuff. And of course, I didn't realize that half the stuff I already knew on the radio was theirs. Like, I mean, this, I know it sounds ridiculous, but I go, oh, they did that too, you know. So I came in it from a very strange angle, you know.
Now, before you even assembled any piece of footage, did you go back, watch any of their concerts?
Well, I watched Live Aid to refresh my memory, but then I sort of didn't want to watch it again because the idea wasn't to duplicate Live Aid. It was to see it in a different way. You know, maybe if you were a fly on the wall on the stage or, you know, you're behind the piano, you can see from a different angle. And so I didn't want to be influenced by it. I mean, so I just wanted to sort of create our reality of Live Aid.
I mean, that was amazing. Following him in, him being out there at the piano, just everything was intense about that. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I saw A Star Is Born, I was like, wow, this is really amazing. These are all their shots from Coachella. It feels like you're on stage.
Right.
No disrespect to them. You took things to another level in the finale of
Whole idea of Queen, of course, is audience participation, and you know, Brian May's character has a whole speech about that before the We Will Rock You concert they give. And so that's his idea in the film, you know how it really happened, but basically he tells Freddie, look, we need to sort of, you know, have them sing along. That's what they've been wanting to do. So I knew Live Aid had to be all about that because, you know, as amazing as Queen is on stage, when I was cutting together, you know, when you don't show the audience or feel them or hear them singing, it just did not work nearly as well. And it's sort of power to their own concept that's what it was all about. And so it just creates such emotion when you see and hear them clapping or singing.
I'm going to come back to Live Aid.
Yeah.
Let's talk about pain.
That's what I would always say when I was cutting the film.
Because, really?
Well, it was the first thing we shot. I'd fucking fuck with my head the entire time I'm cutting the movie because it's all about Live Aid. And so it just haunted me forever.
Whenever I had time,
I would just work on it. You know, like, okay, got a little time today. I'm going to work on Live Aid because it's the thing keeping me up at night. Because it basically, if that didn't work, we were fucked, you know, because the film wouldn't work. Because it's the audacity of this movie to basically end on Live Aid and that's the end of the movie. So that had to work amazingly well. Otherwise, everything we built up to was for nothing.
So that's amazing. Those were the first sequences shot.
Yeah.
And, of course, there was a bit of marriage with the original footage. Okay.
Uh-uh. You mean in our film?
Yeah.
This is all original footage. Everything is performed. I mean, even the audience is the fake audience or the real. It's a real. They're real people, but they are duplicated, of course. And I think we had 100 extras out there. That's it. And then, of course, they were scanned and they did a 360 scan of each person, and each person would do every song, sing and clap, whatever, and then they were duplicated and put in different clothes digitally and throughout the audience, and you know, so all that was built.
Yeah. Now, when you worked with Brian and when you worked with Dexter, your style of editing, is it the what we've seen in docs, the Thelma Schoonemaker Scorsese version of editing where the director's in there kind of micromanaging things? Or is it you stay with it, you work on it, and hey, I'm ready, and here it is?
Well, I didn't. I kind of did this on my own because of certain situations. My partners on it became the producer, Graham King, and his partner, and Dennis O'Sullivan. We sort of had a real eye to eye experience with each other in terms of a taste factor. You can't put a price on it. We all had the same taste factor. We all saw things the same way. And so it was really great to work with them. I mean, but you know, when Brian and I do a film, he will say this. He doesn't like to influence what I do because he doesn't want to screw up something that might be germinating in my head. He doesn't want to influence it at all. So he will go away for a while, and I will cut the film together, and he'll come back and react to it. It's just this time he didn't come back because he was,
Going all the way back though to Usual Suspects, was that always?
Yeah, I mean that was his thing because he's just terrified he's gonna influence me to go down one road when I could have gone down another one that he would have been surprised and titillated by. So, I'm sure this isn't uncommon. He wants to walk in the editing room and be wowed and excited by something I do the way he wasn't expecting. You know.
So tell us about the Live Aid finale. We felt we were on stage. It was like a riveting concert film. You felt you were there. You were in the mix of it all. Was that the gist you were working with? What was your MO in terms of what did you want? What did you want us to carry?
The bottom line for me is I wanted it to evoke emotion, you know, that because it's the end of the film. So if you're not moved, it'd be a disaster. So, not to repeat myself, but the whole movie, I always saw this as the Death Star sequence, like in Star Wars, because the whole film's building to it. And in our film, it's like, Live Aid, what about Live Aid? Did you hear about Live Aid? Did you get the call about Live Aid? It's like the build of Live Aid. Even when they were walking on the stage, I made it like a boxing match. I sort of like intercut it with Jim Beach at the controls and back to them walking up to the stage. And he turns around. It's like it's almost like going to go on and you know, have a fight or, you know, on stage. And trying to build the anticipation of it. And so you have to pay off the promise you've made. That's going to be something really great. And so that's what almost shut me down when I'm trying to edit the rest of the film. So I just go away from it for a while and face it again.
Wow.
Because there were so many ways it could be put together. I mean, you know, how much crowd participation do I show? How much do I don't? You know, and there's budgetary. Every time I would shot off the stage, it's you know, $50,000 every time I, you know, show a sliver of green because I got to fill that in with the audience. And so, my original version of it was, you know, much bigger and showed more crowd. But we, you know, the realities of making any movies, you have to pare it down. So I had to cut like $1.5 million out of visual effects to get
it
going.
Yeah. Wow, that's amazing. Freddie the Man. And Rami's spectacular performance. How did you get around that? Like, what was key in that? Was it close-ups? Was it? Was it nuance? Was it?
With all editing, it's you take a variety of things the actor did, and you shape it, give the peaks and valleys, do all the things that you do in your manipulation, even though. That's not dissing the actor. The actor was great, you know. But in the editing room, you're always heightening the performance by shaping it, you know.
And there's a wonderful pace and momentum with the music. I mean, it's just it's a roller coaster that doesn't stop.
Yeah, that was the idea. I mean, it's like, you know, it's. I think there's. The movie could have been a different film where it was much more morbid exploring way more of the darker side of what happened to Freddie, but then it wouldn't have had the wider appeal. And I don't like to think like a producer because I could like to make good movies. But the way I think about it is, you know, if you're a Queen fan, just like if I'm a Star Trek fan, I want to indoctrinate people into the original Star Trek and watch those original episodes and get them and get them excited about it. And if I'm a Queen fan, I want younger people to embrace Freddie Mercury and celebrate him. But if it goes too far in the direction of R, now there's a whole section of people I can't bring in to watch this movie. And so that was why we wanted to make something that was accessible to everyone. And it's a celebration of Freddie, and it does talk about what his darker, what happened to him. It was very tricky in that regard, because I don't think the film would have been made had we not, you know, been able to make it for a wider audience. You know?
Well, the young crowd is there. This past Friday, I live up in Valencia. I was picking up pizza, and right in the room next door, in the restaurant, there was another room, and there was karaoke going on, and there had to be like, I don't know, 30 or 40 teens in there. They are rocking Bohemian Rhapsody, like it just dropped on the radio.
That's great. Yeah.
Like a month ago,
yeah,
and it,
awesome.
Right there and then, that said to me, this thing is going to be huge. And that's the way I know Fox sees it. It's not just those that grew up with it in the 70s and the 80s with Queen. It's the sons and then
I hope so, because they sunk a lot of cash into that premiere. The biggest thing I've ever been to in my life is insane. So
one of the great segments, it's in the trailer, it's also in the movie, mm-hmm. is watching them make Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yeah, that's my favorite scene in the film.
Tell me about that. Tell me about the inspiration and in building that.
That's one of those scenes where it's both a nightmare and a blessing, where the actors go off the plan and they start riffing or doing improv and so forth, and which is great. But often an actor will come up with something, but there's no reaction from the other actor because they're not there. So then after you sort of so what I did is I took all of the improv and scripted it out, so there was some logic to it. Like I would take a reaction from later in the scene to react to, you know, Rami Malek saying something that wasn't on the script, and so it was sort of an interplay. So to me, I was very proud of what I assembled, and what it did is, of course, give it a reality, because whenever an actor does that, it's real because they're not really on the script. And then as soon as I created it, I was angry because I just assumed it was going to be destroyed by the studio or something. So, you know, I do this as a composer too. I'll compose if something's going really well and I'm doing a really good cue or doing a really good scene. I get pissed off preemptively because I know it's going to get fucked up by somebody, but it didn't. It never changed a frame from when I cut it together. And it's a long sequence, so I was assuming that because of its length, it was going to get, someone was going to shoot it apart, and it didn't. So, because it was a crowd pleaser, so I was proud of the sequence, and I'm very happy it was unmolested in the film. Yeah.
And great comedic timing, too. There's funny moments.
Yeah, that was the idea, and those moments would not have happened without the improv. Those were all the improv things. You know, like, Brian kind of shaking, and, you know, that was a line, put more heart and soul into it and whatever, and I took a piece of Brian kind of flagellating his body, so, you know, things like that, and it made it fun, you know, or push the button, Freddie, push the button, and the mic, oh yeah, yeah, I know, I got it, you know, things like that. So
that's beautiful. So is there usually a lot of does Brian usually incorporate a lot of improv on the set? Because I know for an editor that could be a nightmare.
Well, yeah, but I think most editors welcome that. It is a nightmare, but it's a nightmare you welcome because it gives you stuff to work with and I think a lot of editors like to take ownership of something that wasn't planned so they could own it, you know, and say I created this thing because it wasn't really part of the game plan. I think any director is going to encourage an actor to do that, you know, as long as the main plan, there's at least a couple of takes where we got the stuff down that was scripted, you know, especially for an ensemble piece, and if actors are in the moment together, let them do it, you know. It's like when they're doing the end of the bow wrap sequence where they hit the baffles and they all fall over, you know, things like that. And just you want to just let it happen, you know.
Now, as was reported, Brian was on the movie, had to leave, Dexter came in to finish it. What were the challenges in editing for two directors? Or was it basically Graham, Graham and Dennis?
Dexter left after about 4 weeks. I think he was on shooting for 2 weeks and left after about 4 weeks. So I was, which is basically me, seeing it through with Graham and his partner Dennis. So I like, you know, so it was great for me. Cause I like people, I like to be left alone. So just leave me alone. Let me just do the movie. So, and frankly though, the funny thing is, it wasn't that different for me because Brian usually leaves me alone. So the part I missed not having a director there was. When I really, 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 really want something, I can use the director to go fight for what I want, you know, because I don't have necessarily that much authority. So, but I did have such a great relationship with Graham King and Dennis O'Sullivan that they acted on my behalf when I was freaking out about something. You know, and we all had to agree on it, of course, if he agreed with me. We would debate internally, and if we really believed in fighting for something, we would fight for it.
You know? Where were you last December? Where were you in the cut? Because you get footage. Footage is shot. You get it. You begin editing.
You're feverishly editing as you're shooting because you get the call the next day from like the line producer saying, "Can we cut? Can we tear down the set? Can we tear down the set? Does the scene work?" You know, and they're like, "I don't freaking know. I barely cut the scene." You know, so they're always wanting to hear right away how it's working. You know. And I'm old school. Every editor works differently, but I cannot cut a scene until I've seen everything, every frame, whatever. And so, it's a discipline times a million because the film is flooding in, and you just want to cut it. But I refuse until I've seen every frame. So
you technically would not put together a first cut until you had everything from Dexter.
Or anyone, yeah. I watch it in real time because for me, I germinate when I watch it. Even though I'm sitting there tapping my fingers, because oh my god, I have hours of footage to go through. I'm thinking about the scene, and so by the time I'm ready to cut the scene, I have seen my mind. I know what I want to do.
Yeah.
Because I come from the old school where you had to preconceive the scene in your head before you were committed to cutting it on the film, which is very laborious with your splicer and so forth. You know, the newer generations just slap stuff on a wall until, well, I can do this version, I can do that version, I can do 100 different versions of the scene. Yeah, but there's no point of view. So I just come from that discipline.
What was left that Dexter did? Like, what were there certain scenes that he worked on specifically, or was it just exterior, you know, just miscellaneous exterior that or this? Or was it a particular sequence?
It was a lot of the Mary Freddy stuff was what was left over to do.
Got it.
That and you know, a few. I'm trying to think. Just a few, you know, which are tertiary connecting fiber and so forth. I can't remember exactly, but there's.
You know. What was you know, and we talk about a moment when on the roller coaster where, you know, things just kind of come back down to earth for a second. They were the Mary Freddy scenes. And the one that always comes to mind is the one where he reveals to her, you know, that he's bi, and the concert's going on television.
Well, she says, "You're not bi, you're gay, Freddie." Yeah.
What were those? What did, like, when you were harnessing those moments together, what was important for you?
Well, I mean, no matter what the scene is in a dramatic scene like that, it's just like it's. I mean, I have to be. Obvious, but it's emotion. You know, you want to move the audience somehow. I mean, when he reveals, excuse me, to Mary that he's, you know, he tries to cover it and bi, and she says, "No, you're gay." That was another scene where, rather than score it, which is a whole other subject we can go on, rather than put film music in there, which would have been reduced it to like a TV movie, I wanted to use Love of My Life that was playing on the TV. And that was so much more emotional than a cliche film music would have done. So I really spent a lot of time in that scene. Your regular filmmaker, even a jaded filmmaker, wouldn't recognize, or you know, wouldn't recognize because it's very subtle and subliminal what I did with the TV set. Because I didn't want, there's a fine line of like, if a TV set's too loud, you're not going to listen to what their conversation is. But if it's too soft, it's not going to be the emotional resonance. So and then I would edit it so I would time out the most devastating moments of Love of My Life from the Brazil concert over moments of the scene. So. To me, it just made the scene heartbreaking.
As far as, let's talk about music.
Yeah.
Because I think you're the only person in town that edits and actually composes score.
Others have done it, but not to
which
the
is
ridiculous
crazy.
Degree I have.
But you do it, and it's phenomenal. Yeah. And I know, in my head, your theme to Usual Suspects by heart, because that's my favorite.
Me too. I sing it every night. I'm just kidding.
Tell me about what, because there wasn't a score.
No score.
For this.
There was supposed, I mean, there was the expectation there would be. And so, when I read the script, I was like, I don't think there should be any music in this movie, but who knows? And everyone's like, yeah, but you know, biopics, there's always going to be these moments where there's going to have to be score. And I said, that's true, I guess. But as I started putting it together, I was like, I just don't see where a score makes sense in this film because, and it's against my own self-interest as the guy who can write the score to the film and make residuals and la, 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 you know. But, you know, and frankly, I never really commit a year of my life to a film as an editor unless I get a score out of it because I leave my scoring career for so long. It's costly, not great for my scoring career to go away for so long, but it was the right thing to do. As the filmmaker, I was like, no, it's not right. So,
when is that decision made?
Well, I would say the three-quarter mark. The writing was on the wall for a while for me and with Graham. We both knew it, but it was sort of like at a point I just had to say, you know, do you see score? I wasn't going to answer his question for him. You know, he's like, no. So, all right. So I removed my name from the title sequence I created. And what I did is I put, you know, like opera in a couple key sequences where Freddie's talking to Mary because, and it makes sense because he listened to opera a lot. So had I scored it, it would have just brought the film down to a typical baloney movie, you know.
So was there a conversation even with the Queen guys, Brian May and whatnot?
Well, they originally had assumed there was going to be score as well. I mean, original score.
Yeah. An instrumental arrangement of Don't Stop Me Down,
well, that
Don't
was
Stop Me Now, Slow Down.
We talked about that, but there was never really a part in the film that made sense. Like, you know, if he's talking to Mary, it wouldn't make any sense to put an incarnation of Queen over those scenes. We talked about it. So Brian May had assumed that I was going to write original score. And in a way, it was better that I didn't, for another reason, is that I didn't have to go through the whole approval process with Brian May, and, you know, and he would have freaked out about X, Y, and Z, and so it just saved a lot of drama, I think, you know, to not do it. But, and I think the film's better for it. I mean, it makes the film pure and timeless, you know.
Well, how was it decided which songs would go in to the movie?
Well, that was mainly scripted in the script, so before I came along, and that script was, of course, a 10-year development process, so by the time I read it, those were the songs that we were going to put in.
Because I was upset the bicycle
in
the movie.
It's, you know, there's always that thing, you know, it's like I wish there'd been a little nod to Flash Gordon, you know, like a little vignette, like in the working on the movie, but you know, you can't do everything. I mean, that's the thing about biopics, and you just can't do everything everybody wants, you know, whether it's facets of his life or whether it's a song, you just can't make everybody happy, you know.
Did you speak with Brian about and people like Jim Beach about Queen scoring Flash? Was that?
No,
because
never.
It's always for me, I'll think, oh, wouldn't that be cool if such and such a pop artist did the score to this movie?
Yeah.
And then you speak to like heads of music at studios and they're like, no,
no,
that's,
you know,
the worst idea because they won't hand it in on time.
Well,
or
no,
like
normally
that.
It's a really bad idea and normally it's always a rescore. But there are times where it's so much better than if you'd hired a frickin' film composer, speaking as one, because it just brings something interesting that a film composer would never do, you know. And so, I mean, Flash Gordon is not a great movie, but it is great because of the music, and it would not be the film it was ever, you know. I didn't bring it up to Brian May because you never know how people are going to react to a question. Like, I could say, oh, that was great. He might go, that was fucking horrible. You know what I mean? So I didn't want to bring it up, you know. So,
As far as this is going way back, because I'm a huge Usual Suspects fan. So, and I might have even asked you about this long ago. There's always been a legend that there was a cut and Gabriel saw it and was upset that he wasn't Kaiser Soze.
No.
Or that at certain points, different people were Kaiser Soze.
No, that's total crap.
That's total.
No, the cut I did was pretty much the cut that was released. We had one screening in Santa Monica just to see how an audience would react. We had no idea if people were even following this movie or not. And there was a little shoe leather when they assault the boat. And there was like a couple shots of Baldwin that we cut out. That's it. That was the only thing. I think that comes from the fact that Brian had shot just for the hell of it. Because, again, I don't know what John's going to do with the footage, but I want to give him stuff. Mm. He had shot these shots of Gabriel Byrne raising a gun and shooting, you know, and even though that would be a misdirect, you know, I did end up using that because when Chaz Palminteri is talking to Verbal and it's this whole misdirected audience that Keaton was Kaiser Soze, I used that footage where he had just shot that for the hell of it. So maybe that's where that came from. I don't know.
Yeah. Now, I love that movie so much and love the ending so much. It's one of the few times I've actually sat in a cinema and really been jarred by the ending. And I saw it, Lincoln Square, New York City. I remember exactly.
Time
bought
place.
The soundtrack immediately afterwards. Bought the score at Sam Goody's immediately afterwards. I always interpreted that Kaiser Soze could be anybody. And a lot of people would argue with me and say, no, it's Kevin Spacey's character.
I like to believe it's Kevin Spacey's character.
And then in the audio commentary, the first one that was cut for the DVD and for the videotape, it had Brian and Christopher talking over it. And one of the last words, I swear, I think it was McQuarrie who said, it's whatever you want to interpret it to be. Mm-hmm. Was it always meant to be open-ended?
I think the intention was for it to be, this guy pulled the wool over everyone's eyes, and it's him.
Yeah.
You know, I think later, if people were confused or coming to it with different points of view, you could say, sure, it could be anybody. But, I mean, as the editor, my feeling was that it was him, you know. And that so much of his story was true, but other parts of it may not have been true, you know. So that part of what was true and what was not true is left to interpretation. But I mean, it's Verbal Kint is Kaiser Soze, yeah.
So brilliant. Really, really brilliant. There was something you've said before about Star Trek II. If you ever want to solve any kind of problem.
Yeah, it's the Bible.
Tell us why that is.
Well, it's such a good screenplay. It's so funny. I just watched that yesterday trying to indoctrinate someone else into the world.
I heard that the first time from you.
Well, both Brian and I would call that the Bible to refer to. What would Jesus do? It's what would Star Trek II do. Because there are so many, it's such a great script in terms of character development and positing an idea in the beginning and revisiting it later and referring to, you know, in Star Trek II, it's the Kobayashi Maru test or how you deal with life as important as you deal with death and that book ending the film. And so it's basically a lesson in good screenplay writing and also amazing character development and having a character have a journey and go somewhere, which is rare in current films. So that's why, you know, that script is so brilliant. Whenever I show that film to someone, I go, you know, the first Star Trek film was one of the most expensive films ever made in film history. It was like in 1976 when they were making, it was like $65 million, which is like over $300 million today. But the next movie that they made for $7 million, Star Trek II, for $7 million. And so you can see it on the screen that it feels a little more like a TV show. And it's frustrating for me to see a film that was directed, because if had Robert Wise directed Star Trek II, be the best of both worlds, you know. But what happens, but the script transcends everything else. And that's why people love Star Trek II. It's a script.
You know? And you said you can look to it and solve problems.
Yeah, well, it's you refer to, you can use it as an example to someone, you know, to say, look, you know, here's how they They wrote their story and they came up with ways to bookend ideas and to develop a character. You know, look where this character, look where Savick goes. Look where her journey goes. Look where Captain Kirk's journey goes. He's a guy who's burned out and feels like he's aging and he's given up. And, you know, to a guy who at the end of the movie says, I feel like I'm young again. You know, it's like, I'm getting chills just thinking about it, you know. And so it's like, that's a good freaking screenplay. Yeah.
Have you ever wanted to direct?
Yeah, I mean, I did direct a teen horror film years ago, and that's a whole another long story. And I do, but I'm at the point in my life where if I were 35 and someone said, there's this movie, I'd say, sure, I'll direct it, no problem. Well, but when you're my advanced age and you know, and I have a body work and so forth, I don't feel like I don't need to direct for the sake of directing, but if someone gives me a script that's amazing, I will want to do it, absolutely. You know, and so I would like to do that.
So coming away from it though, people, you know, you've got the audience, they're sitting through credits and they're just having a good time without being really corny about it. Have you ever seen that before? I mean, yes, you see at the X-Men movies and everybody loves the X-Men movies. But this is something that really touches several...
You really felt it, especially in the test screenings. And also because this has more humor than we would have had in some past X-Men films. So when they're all cracking up, you know, and you realize they're totally on board.
I mean, in crafting this, is it all organic? Or you're like, or is it like, wow, I didn't... That's amazing that they're responding to
it. Yeah, well, I didn't... I knew... I have a good sense of... where people are going to laugh. It was. I just have a good sense about it. But even I was surprised. And of course, we're screening the audiences who are a lot of Queen fans. But even I was surprised that even in jokes I didn't even expect a laugh. But just it's just a humorous moment. They laugh their heads off. You know, like when Jim Beach says. When he says Miami, you know, like he owns his new, the whole audience loses it, you know, and there was debates like I don't think they're going to laugh when Ray Foster says, you know, what about I'm in love with my car? And I said, that's going to get the hugest laugh. And people, oh, no, I don't sure it's going to work. Oh, it's going to frickin' work, you know. And it did, because, you know. And so the moment they laughed at that joke, which is basically a setup from many scenes before, you know they're on board. And I remember when we first screened Suspects, that there was a joke in the lineup, not the lineup, but when they're all together in a cell, beginning of the film, there's talk about this boatload of guns or something. And then way the hell later in the film, you find out that was just bullshit and the whole audience laughs. And so you're like, holy crap, they are listening to, and they are on board. And so that was sort of that moment in Bo Rap when they laughed at that car joke. I knew.
And when did you set up? Tell us when that joke got set up.
Well, at the farm, in the kitchen, they're ragging on Roger for having written this song. And the Deacon and Brian May are like, you know, you can do better than this. Like, what is this car? What does this song even mean? I'm in love with my car, you know. And so the more I milked that, setting that joke up, the better later when Ray Foster says, how about, you know, that? And then it cuts to the reactions, the astonishment that Ray Foster, this EMI executive, wanted to put that on the record. And then later it's even hearkened again when Freddie's talking to the radio personality in Britain. What the hell is his name? Kenny. I'm having a brain fart. Kenny, what's his face?
They were close. They were very close.
Yeah, they were very close. Anyway, Kenny says, I see one side of this record. I'm in love with my car. He goes, no, the other side. You know, so and then the audience laughs again, you know, so milking the joke.
And that's important to know that in editing, you know, whenever people say, correct me if I'm wrong here, there's something wrong with this moment in the film. That's not necessarily true. It's something prior to that.
Yeah,
something
absolutely.
Needs to be fixed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Prior to that. So that's the interesting thing about editing and setting up.
Yeah,
you're
laying your groundwork. Because, you know, I always say, you know, people talk about the intrinsic scenes or the intricacies of the individual scenes that an editor does in a film. But the bigger job is stepping back and shaping the story as a whole once you've cut those scenes together. That's the big job, because especially in a biopic, because someone's life is so huge and there's so many things, and how do you pare that down? How do you tell that story, have it be entertaining and do service to the character, you know? So It's the macro view sometimes that people don't credit the editor for as well, because that's the true storytelling, you know.
One of my last questions is a philosophical one. Can a film completely be saved in editing? Because sometimes if you have a broken script,
yeah.
Can a film be saved in editing?
I think it can. I mean, having said that,
not this film. I'm not saying film.
No,
I'm just saying in general, because
a film can certainly be made. Let me put it this way: a film can definitely be ruined by bad editing, or it can be, or a film may never see its potential if there's a bad editor. So you can definitely take a film that could have been good and make it uninvolving. As if you are not an experienced or a good editor, a good storyteller. Now, and you can make a mediocre film much better, I think. But if it's really not in the DNA of the script, or if someone's been miscast, that is a nightmare for an editor. I've had the experience. I won't talk about which ones they were. But as soon as you know the actor's wrong, you know you're fucked. And you can try all the dialogue replacement in the world. You can do all the quick editing and the whatever you can to manipulate that moment. But if the chemistry is wrong, especially between two leading people, you're screwed. And so that an editor can make better. An editor can make more palatable. You can make, in the course of making the film, we can all make each other believe that, oh my God, we've done it, we've made it better, it's going to be great. But at the end of the day, it's really not. It's better than it was, but it will never be what it could have been, you know. And that's the power of casting the right people. If the casting's wrong, even if the actor's good, if they're wrong for the part, you're screwed. You're DOA. You know.
Thank you. Awesome. Thank you.